from the heart of our nation's capital, this is Washington Watch Weekend Edition. Now, here's your host, David Salkeld.
This week on the Weekend Edition of Washington Watch, pandemic successes, fighting back on sex ed, and eliminating religious bias. Greetings, fellow patriots. I am David Salkeld, and I'm a constitutional conservative, Christian husband, and homeschool dad. As we draw ever closer to states opening back up and people being able to get back to work, the media has steadfastly minimized the things that the Trump administration got right in its response to the coronavirus. But Rich Lowry, editor of National Review, investigated the positives, and he joins Family Research Council President Tony Perkins to talk about it.
Rich, welcome to Washington Watch.
Hey, Tony. Thanks for having me.
You know, I had been talking about this before I saw your article. And I saw you documented everything. I mean, this administration has done some remarkable things in the last 2 months, only for the media to move on to the next story.
Yeah. So, Tony, I got interested in doing these kind of stories when I did one about a month ago on ventilators. We all remember how there was going to be a potential ventilator crisis in the hospitals. We had a shortage of ventilators. There weren't enough ventilators in the federal stockpile, and that problem was solved. And we didn't read in the press how it was solved. What happened? You know, how did this miracle come about? And some of it was that the models projecting what the hospitals would face were wrong, but some of it was really inspired improvisation by the Trump administration on the fly. They figured out that a lot of the requests they were getting from governors were over asks based on no realistic data or no knowledge of what was going on in the state or how many ventilators they had. When Cuomo said, I need 30,000, if they would have tried to send him 30,000, it would have been a debacle. Instead, they realized they could do just-in-time deliveries in 24, 48 hours so they could wait to see what was really happening rather than acting based on projections. And then they realized if they guaranteed states that weren't hit by the COVID the same way, that they would get ventilators from the feds. If they lent ventilators to the hard-hit states, it opened up this huge supply of ventilators that no one had counted on. So anyway, that's a long way of saying I've thought the successful aspects of this have been neglected by the press for a while. And I think it's basically the same story with PPE, this protective equipment. Yes, they should have been on it sooner, but once they really got focused on it, they did a bunch of really clever and effective stuff. One is they realized, unfortunately, a lot of this was made in Asia and China. They worked with the six top medical distributors in the United States. You got that stuff, you usually bring it over by boat, which takes 3 weeks. We don't have 3 weeks. We're going to charter planes from UPS and FedEx and fly it so it takes 21 hours to get here. And you get to keep half of it to supply, you know, the usual hospitals around the United States because they'll still do surgeries. They still might have a problem with COVID. But we're going to take half of it and allocate it to the hardest hit areas based on a data analysis from FEMA using FEMA HHS data, CDC data, to get it to the hardest hit hospitals. They cut a big deal with 3M to get 166 million masks from Shanghai that usually stayed in China. Instead, we cut a deal with 3M and told the Chinese, you know, you got to kind of deal with this. This is, stuff's coming back over to the U.S. And they put in these big purchase orders with 3M. That means 3M's prior to the crisis, every month they're making 33 million of these highly prized N95 respirators. By the fall, they'll be making 94 million a month. That's a huge deal. And, you know, if you search for it, you can find this in the press, but it's usually embedded in hostile stories that have very oftentimes absurd criticisms in them. So no one will just tell straight what happened with ventilators and with PPE, with testing. That story hasn't really been told either because the media is just fundamentally committed to a hostile narrative about everything this administration does.
And Rich, you point out in your piece that this was not your average bureaucratic response by any means. This was something that I think only this president and the administration that he's put together with a more of a private sector viewpoint was able to forge a public-private sector partnership that was able to deliver this stuff in record time.
Yeah, so the approach was, you know, there's the Defense Production Act, Korea War era law that we've heard a lot about, that would allow the federal government just to take this over from soup to nuts. Every aspect of the production, the supply chain, the logistics, the delivery. And they thought about that, but they realized that would be a gargantuan task for the federal government to take on in the midst of the crisis when it needed everything working right away. So they rejected that. And the other option would be just to let the market sort itself out at a time when there was this massive disconnect between supply and demand. And markets work these things out over time, but you can't do it instantly. So they forged this middle path where they'd work together with the companies, use their existing supply chains and logistics and delivery, and tap into their data, but direct it. So they kept on making the stuff, but the federal government was making sure that was getting to the kind of hot spots that might have had trouble getting it otherwise. So to me, that seems like a really shrewd compromise, but you still have people saying, and the same people that say this is the worst and most incompetent administration ever, on the one hand, on the other, that it should take over the entirety of the production, manufacture, and supply chain and delivery of this stuff, which makes no sense.
I mean, they can't do anything right. I think the president could cure cancer and he'd be accused of making hospitals go out of business. I mean, it's just...
Yeah, well, a classic example of this is Chuck Schumer has been on TV saying, Mr. President, we need a general. We need a military leader in charge of our supply chain. At the very same time, since mid-March, we've had a military leader in charge of the supply chain, Admiral Plavchuk, who's, you know, didn't fall off the turnip truck. He was the vice director of logistics of the Joint Chiefs, and he's been honchoing this from the beginning. But there's just such a level of ignorance on top of the hostility that, you know, CNN anchors don't stop and say, well, wait a minute, there's an admiral in charge of this. You say it should be a general, but it's an admiral. So it's just that kind of thing just over and over again. And we've never had as much news as we've had in this era, as many different sources of news. At the same time, we've been so poorly informed because there's such a herd instinct on the part of the media, and it's so hostile to the administration.
You're listening to Washington Watch. I'm Tony Perkins, your host. Rich Lowry, my guest. He's the editor of National Review, author of The Case for Nationalism, and has a great article that I would encourage you to take a look at. You can find it. Go to TonyPerkins.com. Follow the links over. You mentioned a moment ago we were just the issue of testing, because that's what they're latching on to now. Nancy Pelosi over the weekend on the Sunday shows saying that testing is everything. We've got to have the testing, and we're not getting the testing. And this idea that every American has to be tested for what? I mean, if you're not sick, why are you going to be tested?
Yeah, well, you want to have a certain amount of surveillance to make sure that nothing's bubbling on the surface if you're not aware of. But this is another narrative that is past its sell-by date. There is a story actually in the Washington Post, to give them credit, yesterday or today, about how a lot of states now, they have more testing capacity than they have testees. They're desperately trying to get people to show up for tests. So we've had this discussion of a shortage of testing, and we certainly did have that at the beginning, you know, for months and months now, and no one's really readjusted to the fact that beginning about a month ago, the testing kicked into a different gear. It's been going up. We've been almost at 400,000 a day for a while now, and it's going to go up from there. And as you pointed out at the beginning, you know, in the fall, we should be able to do a massive amount of testing if it's necessary. And another false media narrative is because you're getting more testing in a lot of these states, you're going to find some more cases. So then they point and say, aha, you know, this is a debacle. In Georgia, they're increased, or in Texas, they're increased cases. Well, it's only a function of the increased testing. And what you really want to focus on, as you know, is the positivity rate. You know, right. And places like Texas, that's been going down. Places like Florida, you know, it's been under 5%. So the media is just unwilling to accept any good news about the trajectory of this epidemic. Cautious, but clearly we're on the other side of the curve of this thing.
And the testing, there's a story behind the testing as well. It's the issue of the private public partnership where it used competition to get people out there to create these tests.
Yeah, so, you know, the testing, as Jared Kushner says, you know, gravity and time make it impossible to do things instantly, right? And it turned out there were a lot of basic things that we weren't making in this country anymore. And you just can't conjure those out of thin air. It takes some time to develop the manufacturing capacity and get the companies up and doing it. But we're in that better place now.
Well, Rich Lowry, great article. I'm so glad you wrote it because it, as I said, unpacked in great detail what I saw happening, you know, from a 30,000-foot view, how they just hounded the president on one thing. He solved it. They went to the next. He solved it, and they went on to something else. So great read, folks. I encourage you to take a look at it. Again, Rich, thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, thanks, Tony. God bless.
You can find out more about Rich Lowry and National Review when you visit TonyPerkins.com. We'd also encourage you to continue your support of our ongoing efforts with a financial gift when you visit TonyPerkins.com and click on the donate button. That's TonyPerkins.com.
What are you reading this season? Looking for timely and original commentary on human dignity, marriage, and religious liberty? We've got you covered at frcblog.com. The content on our blog is written by policy experts, FRC staff, and outside contributors. Read about a range of topics from world abortion leaders exploit pandemic to advance self-managed abortions, and online outreach, how to continue fulfilling the Great Commission during the coronavirus. Stand for truth and stay informed at frcblog.com.
Welcome back to the weekend edition of Washington Watch. I'm David Salkeld. You know, it wasn't that long ago that sex education was an uncomfortable hour or two, exploring human growth and development. Today, it's much more graphic and features popular buzzwords like inclusivity and sex positivity. FRC's Senior Fellow and Director of Human Dignity, Kathy Roos, joins Tony Perkins to talk about how parents can fight back, as well as FRC's new resource called Sex Education in Public Schools, Sexualization of Children, and LGBT Indoctrination. Here's Tony Perkins.
Coronavirus has brought education back home for many families. And one of the things they've discovered is what their kids have been taught. And a new publication documents how education has given way to indoctrination. And joining me now to talk about this is FRC Senior Fellow and Director of the Center for Human Dignity, Kathy Roos. Kathy, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thank you, Tony. I'm glad to be with you.
And you have a new publication, and it's all about this issue of sex education. This is not what those of us who were in school, you know, 30 years ago or so had as sex education.
No, it's changed quite a lot. And there are really two problems that parents have with today's sex education. And one is that it unnecessarily sexualizes children. At younger and younger ages, more and more graphic material, teaching things to kids like how to consent to sex. I mean, it's outrageous. And then the other problem is really the indoctrination. And it's a radical sexual ideology that is being indoctrinated, that kids are being subjected to. And that includes things like transgenderism, born in the wrong body lessons, and all of the LGBT crusade, which has really become the heart of sex ed lessons today. So we have two fronts to fight this on, and actually two battlefields. I'm getting out beyond where I can do metaphors properly here, but because it's not only the sex ed classes, but it's also the policies and what's in the hall rooms and what's on the calendar and what's in history class. So it's spreading beyond sex ed class into sort of the whole environment of the school.
Well, this month, I believe, is it Sex Ed for All Month?
It is.
Where, I mean, this is, as you say, permeating mm-hmm. education. And let me ask you this question, because as you talk about the sexualizing of our children, mm-hmm. it's creating pressure, from my perspective, as I read the reports and see the information. Is this creating pressure for our kids to engage in this behavior because it's just filling their mind with so much stuff?
Well, research is showing just that. That there have been two major research studies. studying basically meta-analyses where they study studies about school-based sex ed. One was a couple of years ago, and the other one was just recently. And they both found that school-based sex ed programs are failing at a rate of 87%. What does failure mean? It means that they're failing to postpone sexual activity in kids. They're failing to prevent teen pregnancy. And shockingly, Tony, a substantial minority of these programs are actually increasing sexual activity, increasing the number of sex partners, increasing sexual experimentation by kids. So absolutely, what you think would happen is happening.
So the question, Kathy Roos, is why is this being taught?
Well, it is being taught by to understand why, you see who. And who are Planned Parenthood, the largest provider, they claim to be, of sex ed in the country. CECAS, which is the original creator of institutionalized sex ed education, and the SPLC, Southern Poverty Law Center, and others. So these are powerful, wealthy, in some cases international pressure groups that are using sex ed to push really a political agenda. And they're not even they're not even shy about that anymore. They're candid about that. CECAS, which is the largest sex ed promoter, I think, at least institutionally, has rebranded itself now, and they call themselves Sex Ed for Social Change. So it's not about education anymore. It's about promoting social justice warriors. It's about gender ideology. It's even about eradicating white privilege. That's what we're doing this month in Sex Ed for All Month. So it's using kids as pawns. It's indoctrinating them and using sex education as the tool to reach them. And it's all behind parents' backs.
Right.
Parents are the enemies.
And the parents don't know about it, and they don't want the parents to know about it. But when you lead children down this path of early sexual exposure and engagement, this sows moral chaos and confusion into their lives and, of course, makes it easier for this agenda of the left who would be advanced in society.
Yeah, it really is about getting children off balance, so much so that they can't even rely on reality in these lessons. One of the most sinister developments, of course, is this transgender ideology where children are taught that they could be born in the wrong body. Talk about getting a child off balance.
Planting so that seeds of doubt.
Absolutely. So they have no firm ground to stand on, and they're much more easily to manipulate then.
And it also encouraged them not to talk to their parents.
Yes. I mean, some of the lessons, and over the research I've done for this pamphlet, the lessons are so manipulative. They use techniques where I used to think, but now I thought, and they have the children kind of use this language, which is used in psychological manipulation. They require certain language changes on the part of kids, which we know, you know, is a way to manipulate people, you know, manipulating the language that they're allowed to use. There's so much that's being done that parents have no idea about, which is one of the reasons why we needed to bring all this together in a pamphlet. And it shows what's happening all across the country. It's not just New York. It's not just California.
It's everywhere.
It's everywhere.
We don't have the time to go into all of this, but I want people to know about this new publication, Sex Education in Public Schools, Sexualization of Children and LGBT Indoctrination. This is not only telling what the problem is, but also gives parents action steps.
Absolutely. Yes, we couldn't just tell the bad news. And there are things parents can do and must do. Some of them might be counterintuitive. So parents really need to look at this this new resource that we have. Because we do, as parents, we are on the front lines. And we need to exercise the power that we have to protect children.
And in this publication, you talk about some of the tools that parents don't know that they have, that they actually do have, that they can utilize to protect their children.
Right. And my favorite one is something that we've developed here at Family Research Council, which is we're calling it the universal opt-out. You don't have to wait for the school to provide you with a form to sign to say, I don't want my child exposed to these things. You can proactively fill out this letter, send it into your school every year, and that tells the school that you do not consent to your child being exposed to any of these things wherever they crop up. School assemblies, history class, doesn't matter.
It's time for mama bears to
Absolutely.
Step forward and protect those baby cubs. Kathy Roos, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure, Tony.
You can find out more about Kathy Roos as well as our sex education pamphlet when you visit tonyperkins.com. We'd also encourage you to help FRC continue to produce this radio program with a financial gift when you visit TonyPerkins.com and click on the donate link at the bottom of the page. That's TonyPerkins.com.
Are you looking to grow closer in your relationship with Jesus Christ and in your knowledge of God's Word? Family Research Council has a new three-part series titled Three Ways to Read the Bible. In this blog series, FRC's Director of Life, Culture, and Women's Advocacy, Petrina Mosley, shares helpful ways to be encouraged and guided by Scripture. There's no better time than now to get to know God through His Word and learning what He says about humanity and life itself. To learn more, visit FRCblog.com.
Welcome back to the weekend edition of Washington Watch. I'm David Salkeld. The U.S. Department of Labor has released new guidelines that prohibit the department from discriminating based on religious beliefs and protects the ability of faith-based organizations to participate in federal grant programs. Joining Tony to talk about these advances in religious liberty is the Secretary of Labor, Eugene Scalia.
Secretary, welcome to Washington Watch.
Tony, thanks. It's good to join you.
Well, thanks so much. Your agency also joining the ranks of the federal agencies that are making it very, very clear that the federal government is going to protect and promote this First Amendment freedom.
Well, that's right. And it's, I guess, Tony, in some ways, surprising to me that this is surprising to others. You know, it shouldn't be news, but it is, right?
Right.
And we put out a memo about religious liberty, and I was pleased to begin the memo by citing George Washington and his famous letter to the Hebrew congregation of Newport, Rhode Island, talking about religious liberty and how integral it was to our nation. And then also the famous portion of Washington's farewell address where he speaks about the importance of religion and morality to supporting a democratic republic. It's so fundamental to our country. These shouldn't be memos we need occasionally to issue, but as important as religion and religious liberty are in our society, we know that increasingly in some of the most sophisticated and powerful quarters of our society, religion is something that's looked on dimly and is under attack in certain respects. And so this memo we issued is just one of a number of things that the administration is trying to do to push back and protect religious liberty.
Yeah, before I get into the specifics of how this will impact the business of the Department of Labor, I want to kind of follow that conversation that you started, because the Attorney General is saying something very, very similar to that, that, you know, this is had in years past been a given. Religious freedom, yeah, every American has it. But it has increasingly become under assault. And there's been an intense effort to drive it from the public square. Therefore, there has to be an intentional effort to protect it. And that's what this administration has been doing, in many ways reversing what the previous administration had done. But this is not something you can just neglect. If you don't protect it, if you don't, build that firewall around it, you could very well lose it.
Well, that's right. Particularly because there are other people who are, in fact, affirmatively attempting to assault it. And so if there's not a thoughtful defense of Americans' religious liberty, which needless to say is a liberty for people of all faiths, then that freedom will be eroded because there are people who want to do so. And, there's a rule that we've proposed changing. And by the way, the Justice Department and other agencies are have proposed similar changes that was adopted in the last administration, which said that if you were a federal grantee providing services, let's say to the homeless, and you happen to be a religious organization, and of course we know that it's part of the fabric of so many different faiths to help the poor,
right,
to help the needy. But this rule said that if you're a religious organization seeking to help the poor and needy and taking federal grants, you have to provide a special warning to recipients of that aid that you believe in God, and even tell them how to complain if you try to proselytize. And these were burdens only put on religious organizations. And so it's that kind of thing that we're focused on. We have proposed changing that rule so that there's not this discrimination against religious organizations that are trying to help the needy. And this memo we put out is related to that. It's emphasizing to people throughout the department the importance of religious liberty and considering it in all their programs.
So, Secretary Scalia, this also applies to the employees within the Department of Labor, that their First Amendment freedoms are protected. There's reasonable accommodations made for them. But then also all the grant recipients or those who would apply for grants, no longer do they have to either hide the fact that they're faith-based or be concerned that because they're faith-based, they may be in some way disfavored.
That's right. Again, religion is one of the great strengths of this country. It's the source of so much aid, support, and comfort for the most disadvantaged Americans. And religious institutions, as we seek to help Americans who are hurting, and there are certainly a lot right now, and with this pandemic and the 38 million people who filed for unemployment, as we seek to help them, we should welcome in religious organizations, not make it harder for them. And that includes respecting when those religious organizations take account of people's faith in deciding who's going to work there. That preserving the faith within the religious organization is important to the faith itself and part of the identity of that institution. And we want religious institutions to keep their identity while also providing help to the public and helping the federal government in doing so.
See, that's essential because, as you pointed out, that service emanates from that faith. And if you try to squelch the faith because you don't agree with elements of it, you lose the service.
Exactly right.
And so we appreciate all that this administration is doing. And this is very encouraging to see from the Department of Labor. So, Secretary Scalia, thank you for your work on this. And thanks for joining us today here on Washington Watch.
Tony, my pleasure. Thank you.
Well, unfortunately, that's all the time we have for today. I'm David Salkeld, thanking you for being with us, and I encourage you to be back here next week for the weekend edition of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins.
Washington Watch Weekend Edition is powered by the Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.